Welcome back to the second hour of Issues Etc. In the middle of audio open lines, we finished with 2007. It's time for 2008. 1 week in, or 1 week and 1 day in, we're looking ahead to the top religion stories, or at least as we think they might be, for 2008. We'll hear a little bit from another roundtable, PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly, on the role of religion in the news. I want to hear from you as well. 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727 or issuesetc@kfuo.org. As time permits, I do want to preview the story we're going to be talking about tomorrow with Dr. David Adams, the death penalty case before the U.S. Supreme Court, with a little bit of a news story, but we'll see whether we get there. 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, 2008 is going to be an interesting year, no matter what you think about religion in the news. And there's no doubt that religion will play a part, especially if we get someone like Mitt Romney, who, against hope, might, you know, he's neck and neck with John McCain there in New Hampshire. If he happens to win that and he's back in the race, we're talking about a Mormon president. That could make religion stories for 4 years to come or 8 years to come. Certainly a closer look at Mormonism. Do you agree? I mean, if I were going to guess, and I'm no political pundit, but if I were going to guess, if Romney manages to stay in the race and he gets a chance to shoot at the White House, figuratively, shoot at the White House, one of the biggest stories for 2008 will be a closer look at Mormonism. Mormonism will be everywhere. People will be, they'll be sending news crews every week out to Salt Lake. And they'll be talking about Warren Jeffs, and they'll talk about the history of Mormonism. And you'll probably learn more about Mormonism, good and bad, from the mainstream media than you ever wanted to know.
Why do I feel this is a segment of Johnny Carson when he was the great...
Karnak?
Karnak, and I'm like Ed McMahon, like, you know...
Making
saying,
the predictions?
Oh, the great... Yeah. Why do I feel like, you know, I'm in a time warp?
I don't think Karnak ever made predictions. I think, didn't they do the thing where he... Where they gave the answer and Karnak gave the question?
You're right. Right.
No, you say, you are correct, sir.
You are correct. Yeah. That's what I do every day to you. I just do the bobblehead.
Yeah, that's all you are.
You are correct.
You're just here to sit in the chair and say, you are correct, sir, and laugh at my jokes.
You left out, oh, great one.
Oh, great one. That's right. Oh, great one. Only I don't have the turban. Johnny had the turban. To talk about how much late-night television has changed, I got to talk about this because I very seldom watch David Letterman. I used to watch him all the time, but then you kind of outgrow Letterman, and I still have a lot of admiration for him as a broadcaster. He's got a storied career. But last night, did any of you see this? Letterman comes back. He's been back for about a week now. He's got a beard. I thought it actually looked pretty good on him, but apparently the network executives didn't, and his viewers didn't. And he made hay with it in his monologue for a couple days. And then he decided that the first thing he'd do on his show last night was shave off or have his beard shaved off for him. First segment. I mean, he had the beard shaving, Tom Hanks, and Mike Huckabee. And that was Letterman's show last night. And I'll tell you one thing. It's something Johnny never would have done on television. But and maybe this is just my falling to the lowest common denominator. It was great TV. Watching a guy get his beard shaved off on television.
What happened to your beard? Did you see his beard, Charlie? I don't think he saw it. I hadn't seen you in like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You came back. I thought you were going to be like a Greek Orthodox priest or something.
I came back and I looked like David Letterman. And then, well, I'll tell you what happened. My wife happened to it. How many times have you seen me take a stab at growing a beard?
Many times.
Dozens, right? Until my wife notices. And this time she could hardly not notice because it kind of went on too long. And
that's the longest I've ever seen. Is that a record for you?
No. The record for me, and these pictures have been put away in a vault, never to be seen again. I think the only place they can be seen is in the Wilkin family album back at my parents' place in Dallas. Our first year in marriage, I think the very first year we were married, we took a family vacation. My wife, of course, came along. We went back and we traveled with my parents a little bit, and I grew a beard. And that was back when I couldn't grow a decent beard and back when it was kind of the color of my hair in those days, which was kind of strawberry blonde. And there are pictures of me, very funny looking pictures of me, with a rather very scraggly looking kind of early 20s beard. It looks a lot better now that it's gray and that it actually grows in. So, yeah, it went away because every time my wife says, you're going to shave that off. And what mama wants, mama gets. That's the way it works.
Hey, can we ever play this PBS Religion and Ethics Newsweek audio? I'm trying to figure out my rosters for Justin's basketball game tonight. So
I noticed
if we get to the audio, that gives me time to work
on it.
But
you've got to share with our listeners before because you're going to leave here in a few minutes. Leave me all alone with Charlie to fend for myself. You got to share with our listeners the name of your, is it second grade or third grade?
Third grade.
Third grade basketball team that you're coaching as though you were coaching an NBA team. I must tell you, folks, he spends more time on this than anything else. What's the name of the...
Edwardsville Frozen Foods. And I told Todd that it's aptly, our team is aptly named because we shoot frigidly, so to speak.
So to speak. There's not a lot of movement out there.
There's hot shooting and cold shooting. And
you guys are
we
cold.
We tend to be on a cold streak.
What's your record?
Do I have to publicly state that on my record?
Well, you know, people want to know.
It's 0-3.
So the Edwardsville Frozen Foods are 0-3 for their season. Of how many games do they play?
We play nine.
Nine?
But there's only four teams in this league, and we get two more rematches. So we're on our second round tonight. So a team that beat us handily the first time around, we get them tonight.
Have you decided to go for the...
trap?
Not the full court press, because you can't do that.
Yeah, pick up at half court. The half court trap?
Yeah.
I just couldn't do it. Actually, my brother wouldn't let me do it.
You mean after all of this big talk around here about how you are going to, because the rule is supposed to be everybody plays a zone and everybody stays in their place, and that gives a chance to the kids to get reasonably close to the basket. You are walking around here saying, I'm going to play the trap at half court, and those teams will learn what it is to face the Edwardsville Frozen Foods in battle, and I'm going to win every, I heard you say it, I'm going to win every game.
Okay, I was trying a new strategy. First of all, you don't have to stay in your zone. You can pick up past half court. But I just assume most people would stay in the box area. If anybody knows basketball, there's the free throw line and then that lane area. I just figured most of the people would teach their kids to stay in there. That way you can move the ball around and play different people at different positions. Well, I was naively wrong, okay? I was mistaken.
These are second graders.
Third graders.
Third graders are out there catching people at half court and boxing them
in. And there's only one or two kids on your team that can even dribble. So what we did was, instead of trapping, that's going to be my third time around. If we don't do better in the second round against these teams, I will trap then. But what we're going to do is we are going to pressure the ball with just one player coming past half court, not trap with two guys. And then once they pick up their dribble, we're going to deny the passing lanes. Well, I'll just yell cover, and you just don't let the guy in your area get the ball.
Do you see how seriously he takes this? Now, folks, I want you to picture this for a moment. I know you might be picturing like 5-foot kids out there dribbling up and down, passing handily, small versions of the Harlem Globetrotters. We are talking about third graders here. And I'm not marveling at the inability of third graders. No one expects them to be great basketball players. They're still learning the fundamentals. I'm marveling at their coach who's got this strategy going for Edwardsville Frozen Foods.
Todd, I'm 0-3, bud.
I know.
And you know how much I hate to lose.
I know, and especially at basketball. Especially at basketball. Oh, I learned that you and my pastor have something in common. You know what it is?
What's that?
Both of you almost always nearly get ejected from any game, any sporting event you attend, because you guys can't keep your mouth shut.
I've got a new rule this year. At away games, I sit up high in the upper section, except the last game we went to. But I try to sit up the away games because I got nobody to protect me at the away games. But our athletic director, Tim Doherty, does a great job there as a high school. He's always watching my back at the home games.
All right. Good enough. That's how Jeff's going to spend the latter part of his day today. Hopefully, Edwardsville Frozen Foods finds victory tonight over what team are you playing? You know the name of the team?
I don't know. I just know they beat us handily. The team that beat us handily. And, you know, maybe you should put that in your promo tomorrow. I mean, we'll let the listeners know right away.
You'll find out exactly
how
Edwardsville Frozen Foods did against the, we'll just call them the handy victors.
People would rather hear that than the New Hampshire primaries or the Supreme Court lethal injection.
This is the real battle that Jeff, while I'm at home biting my nails, pacing the floor, watching the New Hampshire primaries, you know, this is the only season of politics I really love, is when it's actually a horse race. I'm going to be home watching the percentages go up and down by fractions, and Jeff's going to be out there, the real battle that really counts for America, Edwardsville frozen foods. Well, here's PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly, a roundtable that they have assembled to talk about what faces us in the news religion-wise in 2008.
We take our annual look ahead today at the stories we think will be worth watching for in 2008. Rachel Zoll covers religion for the Associated Press. David Gibson joins us from New York. He writes frequently about the Catholic Church. His latest book is The Rule of Benedict. And E.J. Dion is a columnist with The Washington Post, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and a professor at Georgetown University. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
E.J., talk about religion's role in this campaign so far.
Well, you know, the Iowa voting in particular, but the Republican side has been saturated with religion, and I think religion will continue to play a big role. First, you have Mitt Romney, who would be, if he were elected, the first Mormon president of the United States, had to give a big speech about this in an effort to push back what some thought was a certain amount of prejudice against Mormons. And then you've got Mike Huckabee, who is an ordained Baptist minister and who has seemed to rally enormous amounts of evangelical support in Iowa. It was said the evangelicals didn't have a candidate this year. Well, actually, they were looking for a candidate, and they finally, a lot of them settled on one of their own against the wishes of some of their national leadership. Mm-hmm. And then on the Democratic side, religion has not played a central role, but both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and to some degree John Edwards, are very fluent in talking about religion. So I think they will be heard on this subject as the campaign goes on.
Mm-hmm. The question is religion going to be as much of a factor in the way people vote? It seems that the war on terror has actually become something that's a little bit of a more important for some of the religious folks. When you look at Pat Robertson's endorsement of Giuliani, which was such a surprise to people, that was based on his opposition and concerns about the war on terrorism. Mm-hmm. And that's always been a case with the religious right, where it's a mix of a conservative theological view with a conservative political view. When in the Cold War it was communism, and now it's the war on terror.
What's fascinating is Pat Robertson does not seem to have delivered yet a lot of evangelical support to Rudy Giuliani, and a lot of the evangelicals on the ground, especially in Iowa, have rallied to Huckabee.
We'll come back to this, but David, one of the things that's going to happen this coming year is that the Pope is coming to New York and Washington. What do you expect his messages to be?
Well, there are going to be two elements to this papal visit, as there are, I guess, to every papal visit, the pastoral and the political. Pope Benedict XVI will be arriving in April 2008, 3 years almost to the day after his election. He'll be celebrating his 81st birthday. This may be the only time that Americans get to view him up close and personal. And they want to kind of see what sort of man he is. They just know him still, really, as Cardinal Ratzinger, his old incarnation. So they kind of want to take the measure of Pope Benedict XVI. Of course, it's also going to have a political impact. The visit is billed not just as a pastoral visit to New York and Washington, but also a visit to the United Nations General Assembly. What will he say? What will his topics be? How much will he play up his environmentalism, which has really become a fascinating aspect of this papacy?
It's one of the things that we're obviously looking forward to. I mean, it, just in terms of something to talk about and something that's newsworthy is a visit of Benedict XVI. And different from the previous pope's visit to the United States in several respects, the previous pope had been occupying his papal office for decades before he made his trip to the Americas. And by that time, he had established himself. I'm talking here about John Paul II. He had established himself as a world political figure, a gentle hand, but a world political figure, talking about human rights, talking about all of these issues that pertain to, any way that he could find a way to talk about issues of human rights. During the communist era, do you remember, it was Pope John Paul II who was not only an opponent of communism, but an active opponent of communism, and especially in his days, his earlier days as a priest in Poland. So here comes this man emerging as already kind of the geopolitical figure. Popes don't get this just by putting on the mitre. They get this by earning it. Now, in the old days, when the pope was actually a temporal leader, a king, an emperor, if you will, in Western Europe, you just put on the mitre and you became the temporal figure. Nowadays, we live in a different world. The Pope is not viewed in this way, certainly doesn't occupy that same position of authority in the temporal world. So you kind of earn that position. What I want to see is, will Benedict XVI come to the United States as a political figure or as a pastoral figure? I know that he just said you do a little bit of both. But when he addresses the General Assembly of the United Nations, will it be as Pope John Paul II might have, as someone who is who has an enormous amount of political clout, or will he address them as, I am the leader of 1.something billion Roman Catholics, the pastor of the largest segment of Christianity on the planet? I'd also like to see if he's going to actually visit. He's going to be in D.C., in addition to New York, whether he'll visit with the president. It would be diplomatically the right thing for everybody to do, and I'm sure it's all planned. What kind of conversation will that be? We'll get the press conference right there that we always get with every foreign dignitary. The president sitting in one gilded chair and the Pope sitting in another gilded chair with the translators, and there'll be the flashing of the bulbs, and there'll be the talking and the generalities and all of those kinds of things. But what will be said there? I wonder what the Pope will do. Certainly he will visit with some of his subordinates in the church here in the United States. And it's no big secret that American Roman Catholicism is in some ways renegade Roman Catholicism, not to a person, but especially among those several hundred active bishops in the United States. Just a thought. I think it'll be a bigger story than perhaps Terry Mattingly thought it would be. But we'll just wait and see. What about you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issue ZTC at KFUO.org. More on the Pope's visit with the PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly Roundtable.
And one of the biggest challenges also for this visit is that it's happening during a presidential election year. And if you talk to some of the leaders in the church, and I know David probably knows more about this than I do, but they're concerned that the Pope's visit will somehow be co-opted and pulled into presidential politics in a way that the church does not want it to be.
What about that, David?
Well, I think that's a really interesting point. And a lot is going to depend, again, on these caucuses and on these primaries and where we're at with the candidates in the election. If Rudy Giuliani is the presumptive nominee at that point, it's really going to put Catholicism in the spotlight. If it's somebody else, that whole issue of the wafer wars, the communion battles that we had in 2004, may be a little more, you know, out of the spotlight. But it's going to be a really fascinating time. A difficult and delicate time for the Pope to come here because he's also, again, at the United Nations, but also in the nation's capital.
I think every word the Pope says is going to be parsed politically, which could be unfortunate in certain ways. This is a Pope whose first two encyclicals are on love and hope, and I hope we hear about love and hope. But, you know, the Catholics themselves are torn between Catholics who want the Church to focus on a very particular list of non-negotiable issues, they call them, particularly abortion and the right to life generally. A lot of other Catholics want a broader agenda that includes social justice coming straight out of Catholic social teaching. This Pope is not at all hostile to the social justice agenda, but people are going to be parsing what he says and looking for support for one side or the other in that argument.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also going to be interesting, Bob, if I might add, what he doesn't say. Officials in Boston were pressing very hard for Pope Benedict to make a stop just even one day in Boston to address this ongoing impact of the sexual abuse crisis that really mushroomed out of Boston. And Benedict and Vatican officials opted not to do that. He'll just instead go to Washington and New York, where he'll celebrate Mass at Yankee Stadium. You might say that Boston got the World Series, but the Yankees get the Pope.
Listening to a roundtable of journalists from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly on the prospects of religion stories for 2008. Nobody's a prophet here, but one of the big stories will obviously be the Pope's visit, whatever comes of it. There's more to come from this, and I want your reaction to what do you expect out of 2008, a big presidential election year? Pope comes to visit the United States, to New York and Washington, D.C., and perhaps some other things are unfolding as well. This same Pope hopes to visit with Muslim leaders, perhaps in 2008. That might be too hasty an agenda, but it could happen. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, issue ZTC at KFUO.org. It's audio open lines for about another, 20 minutes here, and I want to hear from you about what you think will unfold in the news in terms of religion for 2008. 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, issue ZTC at KFUO.org.
One of the things that that will certainly be going on in the new year is more and more of something that we've already seen, which is this closer relationship between religious organizations in the United States and those in other countries. Rachel, you've been writing a lot about this.
The growth of explosion, really, of Christianity overseas is having an impact within the United States. As just one example, the United Methodist Church, which is considered and it is has always been a very much of a middle-class American church, if the current growth trends continue, will become a majority African church within the next couple of decades. They're already dealing with the fact that there are Methodists from the Philippines and from Korea who are planting churches within the United States as well, and they're trying to figure out the relationship there. Another impact of it is that a lot of very entrepreneurial, very evangelical-minded or evangelically-minded African pastors are coming over here to plant churches in the United States. Now, for people who don't watch these things closely, they are puzzled. Why does, in a very religious country, does anyone need to plant more churches? But these are very fervent believers, and they think that the American church has lost its spirit and has become co-opted so much by the culture that they're here to save us.
All right, we got to stop it here, take a break, and when we come back, about 10 more minutes in audio open lines, listening to this roundtable of journalists on PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly, opining about the possibilities of religion news for 2008. Most of what they've said there is pretty likely, pretty safe. Do you have any ideas along those lines? 1-800-730-2727, issue ZTC at KFUO.org, or 505-7850. I know it will be the story, if it happens. I'm not saying it's going to happen in 2008, but every year that passes, it becomes more and more likely and eventually inevitable that it will occur. Ruth Graham died this last year. Billy can't last forever. Billy Graham dies, biggest story of the year, hands down. No, it may even be the top news story period of the year, apart from the presidential election. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, issue ZTC at KFUO.org. As you go home tonight and you go to our website, issuesetc.org, look for Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. It's an international relief agency concerned with both body and soul. Find out what they're doing around the world to help those who are in need and extend to them that touch of mercy. Issuesetc.org, or earmark a donation for them. Any of their works around the world, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438. Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. When we come back, 10 more minutes of audio open lines, and then Doug LeBlanc will join us to talk about a men's movement called the Mankind Project. He's written about it in the Christian Research Journal. We'll be talking with David Gittrich, a state development director for Kansans for Life, about that grand jury convening over abortion, Dr. George Tiller's abortion clinic.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. Regular guest, Dr. Jeff Gibbs, on why a man should consider studying for the pastoral ministry.
Three reasons come to mind. The first, Christ needs pastors for his church. This is the way God works. He chooses men to be under-shepherds, to guide and to feed his people. Second, the thought of being a pastor is a joyful thought. Intimidating, to be sure, but great joy is out there in front of you as you consider the possibility of studying for the ministry. Third, other respected Christians have looked you in the eye and said, "I think you should study for the ministry." For these three reasons, you might consider studying for the holy ministry to be a pastor in Christ's church.
For more information, check out the logos for Concordia Seminary in St. Louis and Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer.
The U.S. Supreme Court disappointed right-to-life groups yesterday. The nation's highest court refused to hear a case that would have revived Michigan's partial birth abortion ban. After years of being tied up in the courts, the Wolverine State is now forced to work on another law modeled after the federally upheld partial birth abortion ban. Josh Montez reports.
Michigan's Legal Birth Definition Act was struck down by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, saying it was too broad. The Supreme Court turned down efforts to restore the law, and now it is officially dead. But Brad Snavely with Michigan Family Forum says there is a silver lining to the story.
We have a strong pro-life majority in the Michigan legislature, in that both the House and the Senate, and I think there's a lot of interest in moving ahead and once and for all, outlawing something so terrible as partial birth abortion.
Moving ahead means starting from scratch with legislation modeled after the federal partial birth abortion ban. Ed Rivett is with Michigan Right to Life.
We do have a version in the House and our Michigan Senate both ready to go. We believe the chairman in the Senate committee is very favorable to moving the bill in the immediate future.
Last year, right after the Supreme Court upheld the federal ban on PBA, Louisiana put its own policy in place with strict penalties. Miley Smith with Americans United for Life applauds that move and says there's another reason for states to follow suit.
They can step in and enforce the law even if the federal government is not enforcing the federal partial birth abortion ban.
Two other states, Utah and Missouri, have enforceable bans on partial birth abortion. For Family News and Focus, I'm Josh Montez.
Michigan's PBA ban was modeled after Nebraska's. It was also struck down. The federal ban was upheld by the Supreme Court. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
If you're seeking a job or a new career, turn to the Missouri Career Center, St. Louis County. Employers are looking to fill a wide array of positions. Workforce development professionals, part of the St. Louis County Department of Human Services, offer skill set identification, even training for qualified candidates. While you're there, check out greathires.org, Missouri's premier job search engine. For information, contact the Missouri Career Center, St. Louis County.
Here's what Dr. Dale Meyer has to say about the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, titled Visitation. Quote, "Visitation is an essential tool for comforting others in their difficult times," unquote. You can find out more about this resource by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 or look for the cover of Visitation on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Visitation costs $27.99 plus shipping and handling. The title again is Visitation.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Listening to some opinion about what might be happening in 2008 in terms of the news. The big story, of course, the Pope's going to be visiting the United States. There's going to be the question of what role religion plays in the presidential elections. Those are the two big ones I mentioned before the break, and they don't get to this because, of course, it's sheer speculation. But should Billy Graham pass away in 2008 or any year, probably top religion story. Without any close seconds there. They're going to go on to talk about the Episcopal Church USA, which is one of those perennial stories. Now, if things were bad for the Episcopal Church USA in 2007, they don't look like they're getting any better. I've talked with several bishops on the very issues surrounding the defections from the Episcopal Church USA and the problems that they're having with worldwide Anglicanism. I've asked them the question, is it getting better, is it waning, or is it getting worse? And they said, every single one of them, not in so many words, but in effect, this is just the beginning. So maybe 2008 we'll see more defections from the Episcopal Church USA. What do you think for 2008? What do you think should be, what do you think will be the top religion story? I got to take that back. Next to the death of Billy Graham, should it occur, if Mitt Romney is elected, and it's still too soon to tell, if Mitt Romney is elected, that might be a contender for top religion story of 2008. But those two would be runaway first places contending for the same spot. Am I wrong? 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or issuesetc at kfuo.org. And don't get me wrong, I am not wishing Billy Graham any ill will whatsoever. I'm just saying The old guy can't last forever. In fact, I think it was last year sometime, Jeff mistakenly thought Billy Graham had already died. Didn't you at one point? Didn't we have a conversation where you said, well, didn't he die? And I thought, no, I couldn't have missed the death of Billy Graham.
I think you're right.
And it was Ruth Graham who actually passed away. But for some reason, you had like a mid-aged brain.
But I didn't confuse him with Ruth Graham. I thought it was before Ruth Graham. We were talking about Ruth Graham's death. And I said,
wasn't Billy
dead? You and I could die.
Absolutely.
You know, if I lose this game tonight, I probably will die.
None of us can last forever, but you know, you look at Billy Graham, he is getting on in years. There's no two ways about it. And although I wish him all the best health for his remaining days, there are people already have written his obituary. You know this. I mean, if you were in real journalism and not doing what you're doing right now with this bozo, you would have probably, if you're working the religion desk, you would have written the obituary for Billy Graham years ago, wouldn't you have? I mean, don't newspapers do this? Don't television broadcast centers do the package on Billy Graham so that the minute he dies, they can roll it right off the top?
Oh, no.
They do it for all the celebrities. They have obit files. You know, it doesn't matter how old they are.
No, I'm talking about like the video package. That those things aren't done in advance.
I think they are.
Really?
I bet you they assemble at least the bones of a video package for Billy Graham.
If they're famous enough, they've got this obit file ready to go.
I mean, so you might be right.
Probably shows why you're working here, not in real journalism.
Yeah. Charlie should be doing my job. Mine's actually, Charlie will be doing my job in about 10 minutes.
Mine's ready. It's about 15 seconds long.
Yeah. Someone's already written my obituary, but, you can dream, guys.
You know my top religion story for last year?
What?
We're still on the air. That's my top religion story.
Oh, you mean
story.
Issues, et cetera, yeah, still
yeah.
on the air?
It's the grace yeah. of God.
Did
every
you
year.
Expect? Did you expect, when was it that we were defunded down to the bone? The national program.
It was,
what year was
2001
that?
Or 2002.
2001 or 2002. Honestly, if I would have told you that night when you called me and said, I think your only words were like budget cuts. And of course, I was too naive at the time to be nervous about that kind of thing. I was still thinking, oh, don't worry. We'll still be on the air. If anyone would have said that 6 years later, we would actually still be on the air, that we'd be on at 9 o'clock with the Bot Radio Network, on whatever 77 stations they've got going, plus all the other affiliates, Chicago, Detroit, Minneapolis. Why am I forgetting the other two big
Milwaukee,
markets?
San Francisco.
Milwaukee and San Francisco whatever. And St. Louis. And then a smattering of other stations. If I would have said, no, Jeff, 6 years from now, this is what it's going to look like, you would have probably come over to my house and personally escorted me off to the booby hatch.
It's the grace of God. Grace of
only
God.
The grace of God. Of course, that's always the story, isn't it? That's always the story. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Here's some more from this panel assembled by PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly.
Meanwhile, some U.S. Episcopalians are separating themselves from the main Episcopal Church and putting themselves under the authority of Nigerians or others in Africa or South America. Bring us up to date on that.
Sure. The Christians overseas tend to have a very theologically conservative view on the moral issues that that we're grappling with here. And what's happening is that conservatives, theological conservatives in the United States, are making common cause with like-minded conservatives overseas. The Episcopal Church is not cracking up. It's a very small comparative number of churches that have actually left the Episcopal Church, about 55 as of this date out of more than 7,000 congregations in the United States. But it's not just the numbers. A lot of those churches are some of the most vibrant churches within the Episcopal Church. And just recently, an entire diocese voted to leave.
But do you expect more of that separating?
It's not clear how many more will happen, but what we know that will happen next year is a lot of litigation.
Yeah.
And that is going to be very difficult for the Episcopal Church and for people who are trying to leave. It's going to be expensive, it's going to be ugly, and it's going to take a long time to play out.
David Gibson, more on this globalization thing. There are going to be talks, I think, between the Pope and Muslim leaders in response to Muslim request for that. What do you expect to come out of that?
Well, I think there'll be an interesting dialogue about what they have in common, what these two communities have in common. in terms of social justice, in terms of ethics, in terms of things that go beyond theology. I think Pope Benedict has really made it clear that for him, interreligious dialogue cannot wind up by compromising or seeming to dilute in any way, shape, or form a strong Orthodox Catholic identity. For him, interreligious dialogue, particularly with Muslims, is about issues on the ground, reciprocity, getting rights for Christians in countries like Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, other Muslim-dominated countries like that. So I think you're going to see, an acceleration of this kind of dialogue coming out, frankly, of the crisis of a little over a year ago when Pope Benedict gave that speech in Regensburg in Bavaria that touched off a lot of Muslim anger. And it's taken more than a year, really, for them to settle back into a mode where they can even come around the table to talk about these issues.
E.J., Israeli leaders and Palestinian leaders are going to be talking, and some of them speak about settling all their problems before 2008 is over. Can we expect that?
May that prove to be true. It does seem that every presidency ends these days with some effort to bring the Israelis and Palestinians back together. You know, in an odd way, the good news is that expectations of this are so low. What you have are two leaders on the Israeli and Palestinian sides who are in a kind of position of weakness, and that may encourage them, oddly, to seek a deal. It's quite clear that Abbas and the Palestinian side really want to make some kind of settlement for the Israelis. Olmert would like to get it done. There's still division on both sides. It's not clear that the Israelis or the Palestinian people are 100% united behind this, but I think we might get more than we expect, and that's always the value of low expectations.
And Rachel, American Jews are watching that very closely. Is there a role for American Jews in those talks?
Sure. Well, the American Jewish community has always been incredibly active on the Israel front, but there's been a growing concern, and this can't be seen in any way as an equivalent to the life and death struggle that goes on in the Middle East, but because the Intifada has gone on for so long and because the violence has gone on for so long, there are more polls that show that younger Jews are becoming more and more alienated from Israel. They don't like the policies, they aren't interested in the country, and that's become a huge concern for American Jewish leaders.
And very quickly, one other meeting coming up. The Baptists, perhaps all the Baptists in the United States, except the Southern Baptist Convention, are going to meet the end of January.
Right, and this is going to be a fascinating meeting also, which will be parsed in terms of its political significance. These are Baptists who either dislike the conservative direction of the Southern Baptist Convention or never had any ties directly to the Southern Baptist Convention before. And what they're trying to do is come together on mission issues, public policy issues, to form a kind of a counterweight to say that there's another way of being a Baptist in the United States. One of the challenges, though, is that it's being organized by former President Carter, and attendees include former President Clinton and former Vice President Al Gore, along with Republicans, including Senator Charles Grassley and Senator Lindsey Graham. But cynics are looking at this and saying this is a great stopping ground for the religious left, and that there's no presidential candidate going yet. Mike Huckabee had been invited, but there was such an outcry from the Southern Baptist leadership about it that he canceled. He said he won't come, but maybe with his new strength in the field, he'll decide this might be a good place for him.
EJ, I want to close with where we began. After all the talk about religion and campaigning, religion and governing, is there any consensus about where we stand on that?
I don't think there's a consensus being expressed in this campaign. I think there's a slow consensus building in the country. I think there is a frustration in the country with kind of extreme politicization of religion, and religion only applying to a very, very narrow agenda. And I think, for example, there's a kind of reformation, if you will, going on among evangelicals who are saying, yes, we care about the right to life very much. We also care about AIDS in Africa. We also care about poor people in the country. So I think there's an opening up of this discussion in what I at least think is a very healthy way.
Mm-hmm. Many thanks.
Thank you.
E.J. Dionne, Rachel Zoll, and David Gibson. Happy New Year to all of you.
To you.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for the 2008 prognostications from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly. We shall see. I agree with E.J. Dionne there at the end that what we're looking at here is a realignment. of religious voters. It has to happen sooner or later. And you know what? It never really was the monolithic block of voters that evangelical leaders, some of them, hoped or dreamed that it was. It always was rife for realignment. It just took the right circumstances. Well, we'll see what 2008 brings. Of course, what we always pray for is God's will to be done and not ours.
Men, 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 manly men, 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 manly men, men, men,
men, men, men, men, manly men.
Men, 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 manly men, 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 manly men, men, men.
Well, every once in a while, a new men's movement comes along. Some of them are Christian, like Promise Keepers or others. The old drum circles that were made fun of in the mid-80s, men recapturing their masculinity. Doug LeBlanc joins us. He's a freelance journalist, and he's joining us to talk about a men's movement called the Mankind Project. He's author of a story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled The Mankind Project Repackaging Est for a New Generation of Men. Doug, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Always happy to talk with you.
Got to give you a chance to chime in on what you think the top news story of 2007 was with regard to religion, since you write about it so often.
I would say the interaction of religion and politics. I find it refreshing that among the Democratic candidates, especially with Barack Obama, you have people who can talk about their faith, and it doesn't just sound like a defensive thing of, oh, I'm a Christian too. I think Hillary Clinton's talking about it came across a bit more like that, in the sense of she talked about how in her tradition that they seem to have a higher suspicion of folk who wear their religion on their sleeve, and that phrase in particular just sets my teeth on edge, you know, because there's kind of this veiled accusation behind it always. I'm enjoying that that the Democratic candidates can generally speak a bit in a more relaxed way about their faith, and I'm finding it refreshing that just because there's a lot of dissatisfaction with President Bush, that doesn't mean that people are overreacting and saying, well, we must move away from having a president whose faith informs how he thinks about going about the job he has as president.
It's part of the irony here that at least one of the men hoping for the Republican nomination, Mitt Romney, due to the fact that he's not mainstream Christian but Mormon, spent a lot of the time, at least early on and perhaps from now on, trying not to talk about his religion per se.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that I personally find rather off-putting about him. And when he does address it, it's in this kind of wounded way of, hey, we're just another kind of quirky Protestant body. What's the problem? So I think a bit more candor about where the LDS proclaims a very different set of beliefs, you know, especially on question like continuing revelation or on the question of how really all other churches are apostate according to their founder's revelation. I think a bit more candor on that would be appreciated, although I know it would not be politically helpful probably to Mitt Romney.
You've written recently about a men's movement, if you will, called the Mankind Project, an innocuous-sounding title for this group. What is it?
Well, it is a fairly small movement. In fact, I'm not sure that I would have ever heard of it if it hadn't been for writing on occasion for Christian Research Journal and having this story sent my way. I think the alumni of the Mankind Project number in around maybe 3,000, if I remember correctly, from my talking with their media representative. His name is Les Sinclair. So it's no, I'm sorry. Let me correct myself. I just noticed in my article it's 36,000. It's still, I would say, fairly obscure as a cultural phenomenon. But as the headline implies, it takes some of the techniques of the EST movement and tries to weave them into that experience of getting in touch with your feelings as a man and getting together with other men and talking about your father issues and talking about your relationships and that kind of thing. So I think it's tapping into a real felt need, you know, that among men that your life ought to be about something more than what kind of car you drive and who won last night's football game and how much money you earn. But it does offer an approach to relationships that I think would be kind of off, would keep you off kilter. I mean, the thing that is I think probably most disturbing about the Mankind Project from the perspective of its critics would be that it practices this sort of typical thing of depriving you of your creature comforts when you arrive. You empty your pockets of watches and cell phones, et cetera, and at least some of the people who spoke with a critic of the movement, and they spoke on condition of anonymity, said that, like at an EST project, they had people yelling at them at the beginning and treating them, you know, kind of like recruits to the Marine Corps. And as at an EST seminar, your self-image is torn down and then built up again, at least according to these men who talked about it with a fellow named Mark Roggeman. Mark has worked for the Denver Police Department for 30 years and has kept an eye on alternative religions for many of those years. And he had written a critique of the Mankind Project for the Journal of the Midwest Christian Outreach. And that is really one of the few articles I'm aware of that has blown any kind of whistle about the Mankind Project.
What does the Mankind Project, which, as far as I can tell from your article, really does not espouse or advocate any particular religious view, although it might have religious overtones to it, what does it have in common with some Christian men's movements?
I think my impression from reading up on it in this case is that there is a movement in Colorado that is derivative of the Mankind Project and draws on some of the same approaches to a weekend, and attracted some criticism from Mark in the same article for the Midwest Christian Outreach Center. But I don't think that there's a lot of overlap in the sense of I don't think you would find, you know, the typical person who's been a man who's been involved in Promise Keepers, for instance, doing this. You know, Promise Keepers certainly is not encouraging dancing around to drum beating or getting naked with other men and that kind of thing. I mean, one of the accusations or one of the things described in this article is that at some point in the weekend you do get naked and that you're dancing around together in this kind of primitive manner and everything, and you've got this frenetic drumming going on around you, and I can't think that many men would be really attracted, you know, to being around a bunch of other naked men. I mean, just on an aesthetic level alone, you know, I think that would probably not be a very inviting prospect.
The presupposition of this or these other kind of things like EST as well, but it seems to be that the problem with men is they've been too conditioned by society to deny their inner masculinity or something along those lines. They need to reassert themselves or find it again inside themselves somehow and reassert their masculine strength. Am I misreading the less than subtle presuppositions here?
Well, it's interesting because in the critique of the Mankind Project, there, Mark was connecting these dots that the fellows who founded the Mankind Project had gone to a seminar before that was put together by an alumnus of EST, and so it was almost like a guilt by association argument, although you know, I think it did raise some red flags. That alumnus of EST is named Justin Sterling, and Justin Sterling puts a strong emphasis on, you know, you should be in charge as the man. But I know that the spokesman for the Mankind Project said that's not an emphasis that that the founders or that the Mankind Project puts forward. So I think what they have in common is sensing that men need some kind of connection with each other and with their interior lives and senses of brokenness, for instance, and that the best way to get in touch with those things is to be together as men. And I mean, there is a point in a sense there, in the sense that, for instance, if you're struggling with sexual brokenness or with a pornography habit or something, you're probably going to feel more comfortable confessing that to other men than to a co-ed audience or even to your wife, you know, at least initially. So I think in that respect, the Mankind Project is trying to offer something that gives men a way to come to terms with some things in their lives that are probably toxic.
As far as you know, does EST, the Erhard Seminars Training, does it still exist formally?
It was repackaged in a corporate capacity, and I am forgetting what it calls itself. But if you Google Werner Erhard, it certainly you can find it pretty quickly. It was something like the foundation or somehow Erhard was able to take this in more into a direction of business business techniques and the like. Although I have to think that he must have throttled back a bit on some of the rumors that went around about EST at the time that it was really popular. You know, that for instance you were prevented from going to the bathroom except at very set times, and those times were pretty far apart to the point where most people would be pretty uncomfortable.
Doug LeBlanc is a freelance journalist. He's author of a story in the latest Christian research journal titled The Mankind Project, Repackaging EST for a New Generation of Men. Doug, thank you very much for being our guest.
Happy to talk. Thanks.
When we come back from this break, third hour of the program straight ahead, we're going to split that into two, spend the first part of it talking with David Gittrich. He's State Development Director for Kansans for Life. Now, the news out of Kansas is that a grand jury has been convened over George Tiller's abortion clinic in Wichita. The allegations are that it's simply breaking the law. We'll find out about what's been happening with George Tiller, why he has been the subject of so much scrutiny there in Kansas as an abortion doctor, why some hold him up as kind of the quintessential problem with abortion on demand, right after this.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.